You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to three writers here in Santa Fe about a new literary center that is opening soon. And in a moment, we will hear from Ana Pacheco about her new book on New Mexico pueblos, but first, just a word or two from our sponsors. Are you looking for escapism from this world of doom? So is Ariadne in the Santa Fe Opera's production of Richard Strauss's Ariadne auf Naxos. She must decide between dying of a broken heart and running away with Bacchus. The music is gorgeous, as are the sunset and summer breezes at the Open Air Opera House. To learn more and to purchase tickets, visit santafeopera.org. You can also call the box office at 800-280-4654 or locally 505-986-5900. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world, and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Ana Pacheco. She's a historian and author of many books. She's a former publisher of La Herencia magazine, and she has a new book called Pueblos of New Mexico. She will be speaking this Sunday, the 5th of August at 2 p.m. at the New Mexico History Museum in the Meme Room. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. Good to see you again.
Good to see you again, too. Now, this is one in a series of books that you've written by the same publisher, more or less the same format, very photograph-heavy, kind of image-heavy, about the pueblos of New Mexico. How did you come to write this?
Well, I'll just kind of backtrack for a moment. So, five of my eight books have been published by Arcadia Publishing, and they're out of South Carolina. They are the largest publisher of regional histories in the country. And their whole business model, and I guess it's kind of what the way things are going now, is that, you know, people don't read as much as they used to. So they try to get local history out through imagery. So if you have really cool old photos and there's an interesting caption, people might grasp something from that. This particular book, Pueblos of New Mexico, contains photos from 1866 to 1925. And it's basically almost a sequel to the book that I wrote last year for Arcadia called Early Santa Fe, which documents the early history of Santa Fe through the work of the early photographers. So photography starts worldwide in Europe around 1839. By 1851, there are already photos of the Santa Fe Plaza. So that means that these early photographers in a 12-year period had come to Santa Fe, most likely on the Santa Fe Trail in covered wagons or on horseback, hauling all this big, bulky camera equipment and, you know, and their chemicals for developing film. So in the book that came out last year, Early Santa Fe, I have photos of these photographers' studios, which are like tents or like shacks,
right,
put together, where they're having to develop the film and they're having to photograph their subjects there. So this book came of that, because what I found out in researching Early Santa Fe is that virtually all these same photographers had photographed the Indian pueblos. So I cut the Pueblo book off at 1925, because by 1925, everybody's photographing the pueblos.
So this is really image heavy. It's from a very specific period, as you say. And of course, there's photographs by Edward Curtis, who is such a famous photographer of Native people and of pueblos here in New Mexico. But there's a lot of other photographers here. Who were these people?
Well, none of them were from here, with the exception, well, in my book, Early Santa Fe, John Candelario, he is actually a local boy. His father had the Candelario tourist shop. It's still there. It was called on San Francisco Street. So he was actually from here. But all these early photographers came from other places. So one of the more preeminent or most popular ones from that era was Ben Wittick. And I believe he comes from Wisconsin. And so all these early photographers, they just hit the road. Many of them worked for the railroad. They just, different people found their way around the country to photograph these different things. George Bennett came out here. So they were just from other places, St. Louis, Wisconsin, some from Colorado, just from different places. And they came out here because, and I talk about this in my book, Early Santa Fe, to come to Santa Fe at the beginning of the 20th century for anthropologists, archaeologists, photographers, artists, I mean, they hit pay dirt. I mean, this incredible, the vistas, the light. But then there are 19 Indian pueblos here. So, I mean, you don't have to travel to another country to get this kind of exotic, you know, these people from, you know, the cultures that most people back east or the places were not familiar with.
So it's very much an outsider's perspective. And now we have a lot of Native artists and Native photographers representing filmmakers and so on, representing themselves in their own world. But this was an outsider's view. And I couldn't help, as I was looking at these photographs, many of which are wonderful, on the one hand, they're really important because they're documents of a time and place, which in many ways is gone. On the other hand, they're such a, you know, either romanticizing or exoticizing or, in a sense, almost another form of kind of exploitation of those resources.
And actually, there's been documentation about that, not just by the Native people, but others, about how these early ethnographers and different people did kind of exploit the Native people. And, you know, my whole reason for doing this is because if these images don't get out, you know, if unless you're a researcher or a scholar, you're not going to know that these photos even exist. And so for me, as a writer with a great interest in history of this area, I just thought it would be important to get these images out. Because, and I tried my best. I reviewed over 1,000 images and 220 ended up in this book. I tried my best to use images, the imagery that had names attached, because in the hopes that maybe some kid on the Pueblo or say, that's my great-great-grandfather or something. So from a historic perspective, I'm just trying to get this information out. But yeah, it is a, they do romanticize it. And a lot of these are like studio portraits where they're posed photos. And again, you know, I agree with many people. Many of them did exploit it, but still they exist. And Native people back in 1866 were not photographing themselves. So from that perspective, it's kind of like the early artists that came in the beginning of the 20th century. They all painted the Indians and their pueblos and different things. And so in a sense, they were selling those paintings. There was a form of exploitation. I'm not here to say that was wrong or right. I am just here to make sure that this information is out in the general public, because you just have to take it with a grain of salt. There's a lot of good in that there's a document, there's a record of all of this.
Did you work with some Pueblo people in putting this together?
I actually worked with Brian Vio. He's of Acoma Pueblo, and he is the current director of the Indian Art and Cultural Center at the School for Advanced Research. Nice guy.
Yeah, we had him on the air recently.
Oh, did you? Okay, good. And he wrote the foreword to this book, and then both he and Matthew Martinez, who is a PhD professor at UNM and lieutenant governor at Okeowinge, he agreed to review the whole book before it went to press, so to make sure that I didn't get anything wrong. And I made sure, even before I got to that point, Brian and I went through the early stages, and I said, these are the photos I want to use. And there was maybe three or four that were like sacred. He goes, no, don't use that one because it's sacred to us, or it was like a dance thing or something. So yeah, so I'm confident that the information I'm putting out there now is not only correct, but it shouldn't be offensive to anyone.
One of the things that was interesting is there's a number of different places where you talk about the kind of ancient irrigation systems. What were those like? Were they like the acequias that the Spanish brought?
Well, no. For the most part, I would say of the 19 pueblos, probably 15 are somehow situated along the Rio Grande. So they devised these like intricate, I guess, from the research I did, it was pretty intricate, like way back in the day, where they figured out these ways to devise the water from the Rio Grande onto their irrigation fields. So that's the type of thing. So, but I do think a lot of the acequia information that came, that was probably influenced by the Spaniards as well.
Another thing that was really kind of crazy was the extent to which there were witch hunts. I mean, there were, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of people killed for witchcraft.
And that really did interest me when I was doing my research. And when you think about it, and I didn't know this until I did the, you know, the Pueblo Revolt starts in 1680. In 1676, Popey, who was of Okeowinge, he was a medicine man, and who's the leader of the Pueblo Revolt, he and other medicine men in 1676 were brought to the Santa Fe Plaza, and they were flogged for suspected witchcraft. And so when you think about it, when you go back to that era, so all of these Spaniards, you know, the Franciscans, all these, you know, conquistadors, all these guys, they're all coming from Europe. And you think about all the, you know, the superstitions they had in Europe with black magic and different things. So of course they come to this country and they say, they see medicine men and they see Native Americans doing their sacred ceremonies. They're going to all think that's witchcraft. So I thought it was important to kind of that. So that kind of had something to do in a way that kind of added to this whole turmoil with the Pueblo Revolt. But then what was also fascinating is that within the individual Pueblos, they had these superstitions that if something was going wrong in their life, it was because of witchcraft. Or so, yeah, according to my research, Nambe Pueblo was one of them. Some of these Pueblos, they lost a lot of their population through executions by their own people because it was suspected witchcraft.
So Indians were killing other Indians for witchcraft?
Well, they were suspected of doing some, yeah. They were executed.
And were the people doing the executing people who had been converted to Christianity and had changed their perspective?
You know, I didn't find that in my research because they were Christians. What I did find in the research is that a lot of these early anthropologists, they found like little, you know, things in caves, like etchings and different things that kind of, that would suggest, that would hint something of black magic or something. So I think they probably had their own beliefs without the added thing about Christianity. But that certainly could have helped it later on.
One of the things that's so interesting about a book like this is the photographs just don't show the whole story because they can't. First of all, they were taken later, but also we didn't have the kind of photography that happened during conflict situations. But so much of the story that is not represented visually is the story of execution, abuse, conquest, disease, and all the different things that Native people suffered. But you hint at it in the book, or you talk about it in some of the captions.
Well, yeah, again, if you think about it, you know, photography doesn't start till 1839, you know, and the Spaniards are here by about 1598, rather. I mean, there's no way to capture these images, but throughout the entire book, I have photographs, and I talk about how the Spaniards brought all the, you know, smallpox and all these different diseases here, and each story about each particular Pueblo with a picture of their mission church. Throughout the book, there's all these photographs of their kivas, which are, that's their place to practice their, you know, ceremonies, and on the same Pueblo, they now have these Catholic churches. So I try to talk about that and how through, with the Pueblo Revolt, how they were destroyed in different things, but I try to just put that out. So the best way I could, I try to get that out. But of course, even later when these early photographers got here, they're not going to photograph some Indian being beaten up or bloodied. I mean, again, they're probably making money. They're selling these photos. I'm sure the Smithsonian who brought people out here to study them say, send us back pictures of people having their feet cut off. I'm sure that wasn't part of the deal there.
The book is organized by language groups. And so there's different Pueblos that speak the same language. What was the overall picture of Pueblos in New Mexico in terms of how much they communicated with each other, traded with each other, and how similar were they?
Well, you know, I've actually heard, I interviewed Tony Reyna of Taos Pueblo years ago, and he was even telling me that right after Picarice Pueblo is Okeowinge. So from Okeowinge to Tisuque, they all speak Tewa. And he was even telling me that even if Santa Clara and San Ildefonso, which are like right next to each other, they might have a different meaning or a different sounding word for the same thing. So even within their own groups of languages, they may have had some difficulties. In my research, I didn't really find out how the people of Taos who spoke Northern Tewa would communicate with the people from, and like in Tisuque, who speak Tewa. But there must have been enough similarities that they were able to communicate.
One of the things that I thought was so interesting, one of the captions of the photos says that at the turn of the 20th century, these shards of Neolithic pottery were discovered in the ruins of northern New Mexico, and the shiny black pottery was reintroduced to the Pueblos. So that was so interesting to me, because this shiny black pottery, which has become kind of a trademark of some of the finest Indian pottery, was rediscovered.
Well, let me tell you, this is very interesting. I talk about this at length in my book last in 2017, Early Santa Fe. It was Edgar Lee Hewitt, the anthropologist who comes out here. He's the one who discovers this, and he goes to San Ildefonso Pueblo, and he contacts the Martinez family, Maria Martinez, who's the most famous of, you know, she's the one who really made this black pottery really, you know, famous. She's like maybe in her late teens or mid-teens when he approaches the Martinez family. So I talk at length about how he was very instrumental in getting this back.
When we talk about the conquest, it's so horrific in so many ways, and the fact that people survived, that they're still there, that these pueblos and their traditions are really as robust as they are now is just a testament to the strength of those cultures. And it's also, I think, important to note that there are things that the Spaniards brought in that were not harmful, like chilies, tomatoes, peaches, onions, that, you know, just some of the foods that...
Well, no, but some of the tools. They brought the tools. I mean, agriculture changed, you know, it was revamped. They brought in all these tools that the Native Americans didn't have to work with before. And the one thing I have to say about the Spaniards, yes, it's all true what they did, but New Mexico is the only state in the Union that has Indian pueblos. So the Spaniards allowed them to have, you know, retain much of their cultural identity. So for all the horrific things, and they were horrific things the Spaniards did, they did a lot of good things as well. And throughout the book, you'll see photos of some of the different pueblos with the governors holding the Lincoln canes. Well, that was really a takeoff. And when the Spanish got here, they presented each of the pueblos with the three canes. So basically, the Americans just kind of took that from the Spaniards. So throughout the book, it's very true. The Spaniards were horrific. It was atrocious. But, you know, the Americans weren't much better. And at least New Mexico, at least the Pueblo Indians, the Pueblo people of New Mexico have retained so much of their identity. And the reason I know this too is that years ago when all these casinos started going up all over the country, Native Americans in Kentucky or Florida or even New York, they were having a heck of a time trying to prove that they were of Native Americans. Not here in New Mexico, really. I mean, it was, you know, because it's, you know, for 400 years now, so much of it has been contained.
You have in the introduction of your book kind of full disclosure about your ancestry. Tell us about that and how you are thinking about your own cultural identity as you write this book.
Well, and I the reason I put it in the book is, yeah, you know, my family has been here since 1692. My grandfather, several times removed, is Nicolas Ortiz. And if you go to the Hilton Hotel, there's an Ortiz room and you can read all about it. My mother's father, Rafael Ortiz, that was his childhood property when he was growing up. So Nicolas Ortiz, and by the way, his great-great-grandson was Gaspar Ortiz, so Don Gaspar Avenue, that's my great-great-great-grandfather. So anyway, he's the second in command. He comes out here with de Vargas for the reconquest in 1692. He marries Gertrudis Paez Hurtado, whose father is Juan Paez Hurtado, who is de Vargas's first guy. So that's my connection there. I mean, I do have a connection to the whole reconquest part of Santa Fe. And the way I feel about it, and I talk about it in this book, and I'm really honest about how bad the Spaniards were. But again, I just think it's important that these images get out there so that other people, hopefully people in the pueblos will, it'll lead to something positive. When I did this book, I made the conscious decision that any royalties of the book would be donated to the Chamisa Foundation, which is a Santa Fe foundation that provides educational pueblo funding. My reason for doing this book is I'm not going to be trying to exploit through this book and make tons of money. I'm giving it back to the Pueblo people. My reason for doing this is that, again, people, if they don't know these photos exist, I work almost exclusively through the photo archives at the Museum of New Mexico. Maybe people will go there and start looking at other images. Maybe it'll inspire them to come up with another story or another idea. But so again, if you're not a scholar or a researcher, you probably don't know that all this exists. So I'm just trying to get it out into the public.
Ana Pacheco is author of the new book, Pueblos of New Mexico. And once again, she will be speaking this Sunday, the 5th of August at 2:00 p.m. at the New Mexico History Museum. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Thanks for what you do for Santa Fe.
Thank you. You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take just a quick break to hear from one of our sponsors. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/SaveWaterSantaFe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. And now back to our program. I'm very happy now to welcome Bucket Seiler, Christopher Johnson, and Austin Eichelberger. They are all participating in a new space called The Living Room, which is kind of a literary center here in Santa Fe. Bucket is the founder, and Christopher and Austin are writers and instructors in this space. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So The Living Room is an actual space, kind of like a little living room. What was the idea behind it?
I originally got the inspiration to start looking around at spaces just because it seemed like every time as an event organizer and as a writer that I was looking for a space to do anything literary, whether that was a reading or holding a workshop, I was always having to look in other types of spaces that weren't actually necessarily literary spaces. It would be in a gallery or in a music venue, at best in a bookstore. And it just felt like, you know, for the size of Santa Fe and for the number of writers and literary enthusiasts that we have here, that, you know, there could be a spot that was just for that.
Now, a spot just for that, for what exactly?
Oh, for pretty much anything that's related to anything literary. So it's looking at readings, talks, events, shows, and writing workshops. I've really kind of opened it up in terms of just accepting people's proposals about what they want to do in a space like that and what they feel like would fit. I mean, everything from really classic, like, you know, Christopher's poetry workshop or hosting a talk from a author who's traveling through town. And, you know, I have a friend who is a musician who said, I really feel like musicians have a hard time writing about their band, and I'd like to do a workshop where I teach bands how to write their own bios, you know, so it's a pretty wide interpretation of literary.
Let's talk to Austin and Christopher. Austin, what appeals to you about having a space that's outside of, let's say, a bookstore context?
Well, I like it, first of all, because workshops require a certain level of privacy. Of course, because
right.
We're dealing with people's creative work, typically in process. Aside from that, of course, we also have concerns like the noise. In a bookstore, you have people wandering up and wandering away. And so I think having a dedicated space sort of helps eliminate some of those distractions and helps keep everyone in the workshop focused. And yeah, sort of eliminates some of those barriers.
What about you, Christopher?
I'd like to go back to like what Bucket was saying, is I feel like we have a call and like an emerging desire for a space like this. So I think that this is an exciting opportunity to have a place that is primarily for that type of interaction, for people who want to share writing skills, talk about books they're excited about, hold readings, or do workshops.
It sounds like a little more informal than a lot of stuff that we might already have.
Definitely one of the reasons that I wanted to do something like this is that, as far as I know, in Santa Fe, there are institutional places, you know, to take writing classes, the community college, the now defunct SFUAD. And yeah, I did want to have a place that felt more accessible and open and cozy. You know, that was a lot of the inspiration behind the name choice and not naming it something like, I mean, Portland has the Attic Literary Institute, you know, which sort of gives it this sheen of like, there's a lot of intimidation for people around words like that, around words literary or writer. And they think, you know, oh, am I a real writer? Can I come to that? Do I qualify? And that's not the vibe that I want it to have at all. So, you know, having a spot that feels, yeah, it just kind of feels open and more welcoming, I guess.
You, Austin, well, I think all of you, to a greater or lesser extent, have been already teaching. What kind of things do you each teach?
I teach primarily composition, but I also teach creative writing classes at the community college and business writing at IAIA.
And so this would be an extension of your teaching, but like a different kind of teaching?
Yeah, sort of a different permutation where it's much more focused on the creative, which is what I like the most anyway. Much more focused on the things that I'm more interested in.
Like what?
Like experimental writing, queer writing, flash fiction, which is fiction typically that's 1,000 words or less. Sometimes it's 2,000 words or less. It depends on who you ask. So there's sort of strange, out of the ordinary things that not everybody knows about and that we don't always have time to explore in a class at SFCC or a class where we have very specific things to cover that are dictated by an outside body. Here we sort of get to build our own classes and then work with the students who are interested in that. And I think that's the most fun.
Flash fiction, I think at one point was called sudden fiction.
Yes, yes.
And that's like super short. Like you have to tell a story almost without, like just kind of almost hinting at it.
A great example is Jamaica Kincaid's Girl. It's a single paragraph long, and it tells such a great story so beautifully. I always think of flash fiction like you have two different types of prize fighters in boxing. One takes every round and slowly wears down their opponent, and that's like your normal short story or novel. And then you have the ones who go in and with one hit can take down their opponent. And that's like flash fiction. And I'd love to see that elegance.
Right, right. Is that something that you practice yourself?
Yes. Yeah, most of my publications are flash fiction.
Now, how does that differ from poetry? Like non-rhyming, whatever?
I think it's really in the way we explore whatever we're looking at. Poetry tends to approach things, in my view, a little bit more ephemerally, whereas flash fiction is still focused on telling a story the same way longer fiction does, just in a much more compact space.
Christopher, tell us a little more about both your work and your teaching.
Well, for teaching, I have primarily taught poetry for adults. I've also taught collaborative writing processes for more artistic venues. You know, I participate in Meow Wolf. I was an author on House of Eternal Return. And I have taught teens and even younger people to work in a process like that where everybody's contributing a different skill. And one of those skills might be writing. So I participated even in that teaching capacity as a writer, teaching them to add their writing to, you know, three-dimensional art installations or a series of photographs, things like that. But adults, I have always taught poetry, not any other subject. I really like teaching poetry to adults, and actually especially outside of an academic setting, where I feel like people are more comfortable coming in and saying that poetry is to them X, Y, or Z, and they don't fear what people's response to that will be, because poetry tends to be, for the people who engage with it, who express themselves in that way, a very wide subject matter.
I find it fascinating that inside of a university setting, a lot of the time, when it should be exactly the opposite, the reality is that it's not as conducive to creativity as you would hope it would be. And the more sort of highfalutin reputation that university has, the less conducive to creativity it is because everybody's scared of making a mistake or looking stupid.
When you see people aiming toward an aesthetic, and so you see people sort of stifling their own tangential creative mode and urges in order to fit what they think the professors will like or what their fellow workshoppers will like. Or we get so addicted to the praise in settings like that that sometimes we forget to be honest with the work, I think.
And there's also the issue of literary trends. So like whatever, you know, the most respected critic or the most respected sort of form is out there right now, not everybody is going to groove to that. They might have to look 50 years back or 20 years back.
I also think in an academic setting, the teacher needs a quantifiable lens. So when you get students who are going their own way or who have a kind of radical view on what this is, whether it's poetry or fiction or memoir, that it can be a little bit more of a struggle for them and for the teacher who at the end of the day needs to be able to put a grade on that and then weigh that grade against something else and say, well, this is why. So an environment like the one we hope to create is much better for, you know, those who have an interest that they can't even point to why, who like the way that they're expressing themselves and aren't necessarily looking for a criticism that prevents that type of personal expression, but maybe a medium to explore what it is they like about it and bring something out in that to ultimately hopefully make them more satisfied with it.
Now, Buck, you, when you were thinking about putting together the living room, looked at examples from other cities. Tell us what you saw and how this is similar and maybe also different from what people are doing in other places.
So, I mean, I'm really grateful for all of the projects across the country because I definitely looked toward them and modeled after them a bit. Also, in terms of trying to figure out whether Santa Fe would support something like this, looking at other towns in the country that were of a similar size and seeing whether they were supporting a literary space. So, yeah, I mean, I kind of cruised around and spied on what a lot of other people were doing. And I'm also lucky that I am acquainted with David Beispiel, who runs the Attic in Portland. And he spent several hours on the phone with me answering a litany of detailed questions that I had for him. One of the things that David and I talked a bit about was, you know, the Attic has been around for 20 years. And what did it look like when it first started? You know, because obviously now, like, they have tons of teachers and they have this huge budget and they run an incredible amount of programs. And a lot of these spaces started as someone, you know, let's find a little space and run a couple of workshops and do a few things because we want there to be a place for writers and there's not necessarily a place. So he and I talked a lot about what it looks like to start small like that and what it looks like to actually stay small as long as you can and to really grow with the community and respond to what the community is wanting and needing out of a space like that rather than kind of coming in and saying, this is what there is. And that's a similar approach that I had in terms of taking proposals for the space rather than saying, these are the six things that I think that should happen here and who is going to do them? You know, which like doesn't get to be a creative process for the people that are involved. You know, and doing it that way has exposed me to a lot of things that like I didn't even know were out there. So I think that's a little bit different because depending on the space, a lot of places don't necessarily open it up and take from a big pool and work with what has energy and is coming up. It's a little bit more prescriptive than that, I guess, or a little bit more structured.
Right, right. One of the very first interviews I ever did on radio in 2003 was with a Native American potter who talked at length about listening to the clay and not imposing your will on it, but listening to what it wants to be. And it impressed me profoundly because I realized that all creative work is like that. I mean, you're in a continual state of listening, not just imposing your will on whatever your medium is. And I think in creating an organization, you're kind of doing the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, I would agree with that.
Now, tell us a little bit more about your work and your teaching, Bucket.
My work with other writers has been primarily one-on-one client work. I do developmental editing and I guess what could be called coaching, although I really hate that word. But, you know, working one-on-one with writers to develop their work. And most of the teaching that I've done has been in a very informal, like in my literal living room,
yeah,
you know, gatherings of people, which was part of my selfish reasons for wanting a space is I was literally like, I would like to have a place to run my workshops that's not my house. So yeah, that's the work that I've done with other writers. And then my background as a writer, which I think is what has led me to this place with this space, is that I stayed away from an institutional setting for a really long time. I've been writing and taking my writing very seriously since I was in high school. And I didn't so much as take a creative writing class or a critique group until I was in my late 20s. So I really appreciate the value of more informal settings and a sort of community self-taught atmosphere. I mean, a lot of the way that I improved my work and that I grew as a writer before I was in an academic setting was like checking out books from the library, calling people that I knew that were writers, asking them to read my writing, going to really informal gatherings at people's houses. So later, having gone into more academic settings, I see there's benefits there. You know, there's people with a lot of experience who are really amazing teachers. So the living room is kind of like a place that I wish I could have gone 10 years ago, instead of going to the the writing reference section of the Santa Fe Public Library, which is where I went when I reached the end of my rope trying to teach myself and needed more guidance. You know, I would have loved to like come to a workshop or come to a critique group at a space like that. So
very interesting. Yeah. I mean, with all great respect to institutions like the Iowa Writers Workshop and so on, I have often wondered what it would actually be like to be one of the students in that and intensely both learning from, but also like competing against or comparing yourself to other people, all of whom are like these handpicked, supposedly great up and coming writers. And the emotional pressure of that could be as off-putting as it is. I mean, depending on your personality, it could be counterproductive, or for some, you know, it could be great.
Yeah. I mean, and Iowa specifically is pretty notoriously destructive to the tender young souls of writers.
Yeah. Well, and Bucket, I thought you brought up a really good point in that, like, with all crafts, but I think especially with writing and language, so much of it is, and really it's all crafts, but so much of it is teaching yourself and really just having the resources and the comfortable, safe space to be able to teach yourself and to be able to learn well. And some people just don't operate well, like in the Iowa writing workshops. That sort of pressure can distract you from your work and keep you from learning. And so, yeah, I think spaces like this are important because it allows us to teach ourselves.
Yeah, but at the same time, also having those kind of gathering spaces where writers are coming into them, you still can end up with some of the benefits of, you know, I mean, to be kind of crass about it, the reason that a lot of people go get their MFA is they think they're going to meet someone who's going to introduce them to an agent and they're going to get their work published. And that is actually how a lot of people get success as writers. And you know, we have a lot of local resources to draw on here, not in a yucky way, but in a real, like, yeah, that's the way that I've been able to do a lot of the things that I have in Santa Fe, because I know other writers and other artists who want to work with me. And, you know, it's a great place to, like, not only, oh, you meet someone in your writing group who you really resonate with, and then suddenly, great, you have this critique partner, all the way up to, you know, yeah, maybe meeting someone who can give you a connection or let you know about a contest that you didn't know about, or something like that, and not have to pay $40,000 and move to, I don't know where, Iowa or some other place.
And then be in debt for who knows how long.
Well, I also think it's an important kind of space because, you know, if you are getting a grade, you're also at some place like the community college. And most of the people who are going to be coming to that class and working alongside you are not even necessarily looking to create a community around writing. It's just, you know, part of the path there. It's not to say that they don't like it. Maybe they love it. But I think a space like this ultimately has the potential of ending up more like a reading group, a place to come and share ideas, to say explicitly, yes, I'm interested in this thing, and hopefully where people can make connections that keep them moving forward.
The Living Room Santa Fe is on the web at livingroomsantafe.com, and classes haven't quite started yet, but it's coming up soon. Is that right, in the month of August?
Yeah, there's a few one-time classes and events happening starting mid-August, and then we have four or five multi-session courses starting the first week of September.
So at this point, it's not really a drop-by space. So if people want to find out more, they should go to the website, livingroomsantafe.com. Before we go, what classes are you all teaching?
I will be teaching the Fall Poetry Workshop. And I, in case you forgot, am Christopher Johnson.
Okay.
Austin Eichelberger. I'll be teaching Intro to Fiction and an Intro to Creative Writing. And then coming up after that, we'll have a queer writing class and a flash fiction course as well.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you all three for being with us. Bucket Seiler is founder of The Living Room. Once again, livingroomsantafe.com. Christopher Johnson and Austin Eichelberger are writers, poets, and instructors in various places, including the living room, as it takes shape. So thank you all for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.